This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Hello, I know we've had a month gap since the last episode. I'm here, we're all alive and well. It has just been an exciting but overwhelming few months with intensive training of teams. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes with some of those incredible revolutionists that we're working with that are doing amazing advancements with their teams. This episode, I'm excited to expound on the topic of ICU diaries. In episode 132, we heard from David Richards about the impact of his ICU diary on his journey through severe post-ICU syndrome. This episode, Seth Vandermeer joins us to share his exciting advancements that can help open access to ICU diaries for more patients while limiting the workload required for clinicians. Seth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Seth Vandermeer. I live in the Netherlands, which most people probably know from Amsterdam. But I don't live in Amsterdam. I live in a smaller town close to the German border called Nijmegen. I have a wife, three kids, in my daily job, I'm running post-ICU.
Which I am fascinated with this whole concept and company. How did you even get into working on post-ICU diaries?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know I would go in there when we started. It was 2019. We were developing all kinds of applications for healthcare. I was involved with setting up patient programs, patient support programs for diabetes patients for Abbott. And I met two guys called Jurriaan van Rijswijk and Mark Buijzen. The latter one is an intensivist, or he was an intensivist at the Katharina Hospital in Eindhoven. He is now an intensivist anesthesiologist in Maastricht University. And so they were working on this idea of making an app for a diary. And I didn't have any clue at that moment. But it became quickly very clear to me what the proposition was, the simple proposition of having a notebook on your phone to record the everyday things that happen on an ICU. And that is important for the patient when he wakes up, but also for the family and for nurses. So I said, yeah, I want to join. And at that time there were, it was just when COVID started. And that gave the whole project a boost. We quickly needed to roll it out in a lot of hospitals in the Netherlands. And that also then sort of became the start of a company. It was first a project and it became a company because of the fact that we were dedicating so much time on it that we needed to separate it from the other things that we were doing. And that's how it started.
So interesting. And we've had David on the podcast talking about his journey through ARDS and ECMO. And this was in the early 2000s. So without this kind of technology, and even they didn't have clear instructions on this. It was just his partner at the time was kind of a scrapbooker and had intuition. She just knew that this was going to be a very impactful event in David's life. And so she started to document it. So he talked about what that meant to him. But in the bigger picture, why are ICU diaries needed?
Yeah, so the whole idea of the ICU diary started around 20, 25 years ago in a more formal way, where hospitals in Scandinavia started to log these events because they somehow had the idea that it could be beneficial to patients because they know, of course, about the then not known post-intensive care syndrome. It was still called something else, like anxiety, depression. But they had this feeling like, well, this memory loss or this memory gap and the problems that people have with their, understanding things, sort of dementia kind of problems, that they were probably caused by something that we now call post-intensive care syndrome. So they started to just write down, mainly nurses, write down not the medical events, but the other things that happened with and around the patient. Things like who visited, what was going on during that day, what they observed on the patient, like they had their eyes open or not. So with that idea, they started to experiment, and everyone did it in his own way, right? So everyone had this like scrapbook kind of mentality or a notebook kind of mentality, and just write things down without any clear idea of what was important. They just did what they think was right. And it took, I think, around a year, 10 to 15 years before someone sort of started to look into, well, are there actual benefits? I think this is only like in the last 5 to 10 years that people have really started to, from a research perspective, have started to look into it and started to look at, are there benefits? And a lot of people have the idea that there are benefits. People know from their gut that journaling is something that can help to alleviate emotional stress for the writer. That reading back what happened to you could give you maybe some perspective on what happened to you. And then that narrative can help you get to grips with the things that you were not able to experience or at all, or maybe not in the right way. So I think with that around, I think 2010, it started really to become something that that got more attention also from a research perspective. That was still far away from where we are today, but at least the first studies that we found were from that time. So I think that's when the first results came in, that people were thinking we need to find a way to introduce this as a part of the care for the patient.
And I'm thinking back to my time in the Wake and Walking ICU that I worked at. I started there in 2012, and it was probably right before COVID hit that we started to really try to roll out post-ICU diaries. Mm-hmm. And even though we had this really great approach to be aware of delirium, prevent, treat it, things like that, I don't think I, as a nurse, was really trained to focus on their post-ICU life. Despite our optimal approach in there, I did not understand why we were taking that approach. So something like a post-ICU diary had not crossed my mind, had not crossed, like really reached us there in Utah, in the United mm-hmm. States of America, until right before COVID hit, when I started, well, actually it was Polly Bailey, the very founder of this unit, really started to push for this. And I use it with a few patients before everything just got crazy and it fell by the wayside. So I think we haven't been aware, as far as ICU clinicians in the ICU world, we're not aware of what life is like after the ICU. So we have not understood why a tool like this would be so important, or what patients experience during the ICU and what lies ahead for them. Mm-hmm. What other gaps have stopped this from being standardized?
Yeah, so I think the fact that it only was sort of like discovered 10 to 15 years ago, when researchers first started to look into the possible benefits, that they started also to think about, well, if we are going to write for the patient, what would be beneficial to them? Should we just write anything? Because one of the things that, you know, still happens today when hospitals are working with paper diaries, most of the times they're just little scrapbooks or their little notebooks. I heard from nurses that just went to Office Depot to get some stuff and make them themselves. So there's nothing standardized to them. And I think there's a couple of things that sort of, up until now, at least, stopped that from being standardized. First of all, they were not being part of the ICU Liberation Bundle. That's only for a couple of years now that in the ICU Liberation Bundle, there's at least a reference to a diary. There's still no clear guidance on what to do and how to do it and whether you would do it on paper or not, but at least it's mentioned. And there's other countries in the Netherlands, but also in Sweden, where we work, where this is now an official guideline from the Intensivist Association, that they clearly advise you to start using a ICU diary as soon as possible after admission. So this will help, right? The fact that it's being pushed from the intensivist, and also because more and more nurses are and nurse researchers and nursing schools are looking into this and trying to get some guidelines on how to write in an ICU diary, why to write in an ICU diary. I think it starts with that why. That's also, you know, we don't know why we do it. It's hard to make a standard because you don't know what you're solving, and you don't know anything on which steps to take. So that's also a barrier where it's still not clear to a lot of people, not even what post-intensive care syndrome is, but also not why something that sounds so simple and so almost, maybe trivial, that writing in a diary would help someone to recover. And this is, I think, these things are now coming together, right? There's the physical care, there's the pharma care, but then there's also the emotional or the mental care, and that part can be really influenced by positively influenced by having an ICU diary and getting a narrative around what happened to the patient or what happened to the family, because the family are mostly the ones that write the most. So I think that's where it only now comes, you know, to, okay, if we're going to do this, how are we going to do this? Do we need a standard? And to give you one example, we went to Sweden where they were writing in diary for over 15 years already in ICUs with our post-ICU application. And once we knocked on the door of the legal department, somebody woke up and said, "Hey, are we doing paper diaries? How is that arranged? How is consent arranged? How is privacy arranged? Is there any regulation?" And they found out they haven't had any regulation around it. So that stopped us, you know, a couple of months because they needed to make that regulation. And then they found out.
I hadn't thought about that. I mean, a little bit. You know?
So now
certain things that contradict the EMR. How does that play out? Is that something that could be used in court? Or
this goes back to that standardization a little bit, because if you have no standards and methodology and nurses and family members just write in a paper book, nobody knows what's being written. Nobody has any control of who reads it. Nobody knows where it ends up. One of the things that we try to do with our post-ICU diary is that we make it clear that it is the property of the patient, that it's being most of the times being governed by the patient's family because the patient's not able to represent himself, and that the patient's
family. It depends on the ICU.
Sorry?
It depends on the ICU. Many patients in some ICUs can be with it the entire time, but that is a fair concern.
It depends a bit on how they end up in the ICU, right? Whether it's planned or unplanned. So, but we generally see that most of the times there's like a representative, a legal representative, mostly the spouse or the kids, or that sort of take care of the diary until the patient's able to do so. But then, whether it's the patient or the representative, they are the ones that invite the nurses or the hospital to write in their diary. They can set the rules for whether people are able to write, to read, whether to post pictures or not. And then with that, there's a control mechanism. There's a system to take care of their privacy and to make sure that the privacy is respected. So all these little things have helped us in getting on a better level with especially legal and privacy departments for arranging things like this. And so setting a standard on how to do things.
And I think throughout our process of care in the ICU, we like to have routine, structured, and data-driven processes, right? So we like to know what information to put where.
Yeah.
And so something like this, where it's not, at least thus far, it hasn't been so objective. It's been right about the patient's course. Well, and I found when I was rolling this out, I was wondering, what matters to the patient? What would they want to know? So I took care of a paramedic and I thought, they're going to want to know what drips they were on, what ventilator settings they were on. I'm going to guess that they want to know those details, but I don't think that's going to be helpful for all survivors because survivors have tried to go through their charts. I've been contacted by survivors that say, can you read through my medical records and give me a summary of what happened to me? Because I don't know, especially with my brain injury now, I can't process these thousands of patients. So how's post-ICU, has the company helped fill in this gap and streamline this process?
Yeah. So that's a good question. First of all, just to make that clear, the ICU diary, the way that we train the nurses and we advise the family is not to write about medical information. So don't put any medical information in there. There's a medical record that contains, you know, what you need to know from a medical perspective, but really write only about things that are not medical, just observations, experiences. With that, we also keep it really separated from the EMR. So there's no connection between the EMR and the diary. The only thing that's stored sometimes in the EMR, but that depends on the hospital, is like the consent form. So there's a place where you leave that consent so you know that you're allowed to write in the diary. But for the rest, there's no connection. But what does happen, and this is what we hear back from a lot of hospitals, is that because you're writing a diary that has timestamps, you can correlate that to the medical record. So what happens now, also in research perspective, but also just by nurses and families and patients, that they can correlate what was happening to them in a more emotional or even sort of like memory things that they have to what happened medically to them. So were they deeply sedated and that they have certain like nightmares or dreams or visions? Were they more in the delirium phase? And do they see things on the medical record that correlate with what happened around them or with them in the eyes of the family or the nurses? And that gives them so much more context to what happened to them. Not just the medical thing, not just the story, but the combination of the two.
Especially if it, I guess, involves their family members. It's almost like the family members are saying, I wasn't the perpetrator of that harm. I was here. I was writing your diary. Yes. It was at this time. But at that time, you also had a thoracentesis and that pain was provider.
If you look at the continuum of care for the patient, mostly, I mean, hopefully they have family, but if they have family or loved ones, those are the ones that are with them all the time from before they were sick to the ICU and long, long time after the ICU, right? So they are the ones that are with you all the time. And so what we do see sometimes is that because of the traumatic experiences, spouses have different emotions about that time and have difficulty sometimes in the relationship because of the traumatic things that happened to them. And so again, the diary can play a role in at least having a joint narrative or have the proof almost to the patient that their loved ones were with them and not against them, because that's what some delirious patients sometimes think. And the same goes for nurses, because also nurses, especially the aftercare nurses, they often, when they get patients back with an ICU diary, that's when they get the thank yous, right? So, you know, it was a horrible time, but now I read what you've done for me, or that you were there for me, or that you were holding my hand, or you were, you know, were changing my clothes or washing my hair, whatever they did with the patient. And that's a very emotional, but a very important moment for both the patient as well as the nurse.
Yes, because there could be a lot of really hard feelings. I mean, even if a patient understands that they had delirium, without that clarity of what those providers were doing for them, it sounds like sometimes they still wonder, was that a bad nurse? Did that nurse really do that? Or were they doing something harmful that led me to believe that this was a dangerous situation? So having that clarity, would really help. And help me understand, this is an app, correct?
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
It is.
How's it rolled out?
So we kept it very simple. So it's a web app. So it works on a phone, on a tablet, on a bedside terminal, basically on anything with a web browser. You could just go there, log in, and you can write. So it's a very simple app, and it's not a notebook, because we've seen with notebooks that people, they stare at a blank screen and they have no clue what to write. So it has an onboarding. It helps, especially on the family and patient side. It helps them through some conversational routines that you go through to explain them what it is, why writing is so important. If they want to know more about post-intensive care syndrome, they can read about it. And then it starts with a question: what do you want to write today? And the first question then is, do you know what to write about? And if you say no, you'll get prompts. And those prompts, of course, are pre-filled by the experience we have and the research that has shown what are important things to write about. Colors, sounds, what the room looks like, the temperature. It doesn't even matter what so much, but physical things around the patient can be very important for their memory. Or write about their favorite sports team, whether they have won last weekend or not. It sounds a little bit strange to because they can look it up in the paper or wherever. But there's one patient that unfortunately I only have this in Dutch, but he has a testimonial where he talks about that his friends, he was a big supporter of a football club here in the Netherlands, and he was in COVID, had a COVID ICU admission for 6 weeks. So he was away for a long time, and his team had at least 6 matches. And so he always went to the football game with his friends. So every day at match day, his friends were writing in his diary, just like the score, who scored, not because it was information that he needed, but it was their way of showing to the patient that he was still in their minds, that he was there with them. And I think that sense of I was not alone, the world continued without me, but not completely, because the people who cared for me had me in their thoughts and they were writing for me. They were doing as if I was there. And I think that aspect, it's such a strong emotional thing, even though it's such a simple thing to just write the score or who scored or in what minute they scored on a football match.
Yeah, patients that are especially deeply sedated seem to be at high risk of feeling isolated and abandoned, and they lack connection. I just think, besides solitary confinement from torture or imprisonment, when else do we go 6 weeks without really talking to or connecting to another human being? Yeah. So I hadn't considered that showing that connection and that support, even retrospectively, could be part of their healing.
Yeah. So this is what we hear back. There are a few rehab clinics now in the US that specifically work with ICU rehab, ICU recovery. In the Netherlands, it's now standard in each hospital. There's an aftercare department. Usually, these are ICU nurses who double shift almost as aftercare nurse.
Oh, wow.
And so they invite the patients back at a regular interview intervals to talk to them and to their family. So this is where we learn all these things, because they come back, they talk about their experience, they talk about what's in the diary, what it meant to them. And that's where we hear those stories. Those stories, they get told to us by the nurses, but also by the patients. So patients reach out to us through our help desk, right? We're not soliciting for them, but we have a help desk. And they're just sending us like all these stories about what it meant to them. And these
that's
are the
stories. Be part of your successful rollout is the perspective of the nurses. Being able to understand the post-ICU life absolutely has to impact ICU care. So when they understand what patients face after the ICU, they're better equipped to prepare them for that life. I think that's a big gap, at least here in the United States, is that I worked as an ICU nurse for almost 7 years before I ever really talked to an ICU survivor that had been sedated and had delirium. And I remember and I still get upset to think I cared for these patients for so long without knowing what lied ahead. Yeah. And I contributed to a lot of that struggle that they faced because I didn't know.
Yeah.
So what kind of success stories are they sharing? Do you have some examples? We love a good story.
Yeah. So, let's just start with the fact that, being on an ICU is never considered a success, but recovering from ICU, of course, can be a success. So, from the patient side, one of the stories that we tell a lot is about, about his name is Hans, but he was also in the COVID time. So he was sedated for a long time, intubated for a long time. And he was in his late 60s, early 70s, so really a fragile patient at that time. And he really thanks his recovery for a large part to the diary. He says what he did, and that's an ability that we have. He printed the diary. He even made it into a nice booklet, which we're also now offering. He brought us to the idea that you could print it into a book, including the pictures. And so he has it he just keeps it in a top drawer in his living room. And he, now it's 3 years gone, and he says they look in it almost every week. Something comes up, and they take out the paper diary, then the printed diary. And it's a 30-page diary, 35-page. And they just look at pictures. They look at things that happened, because he says, this helped me. And there are so many little things that happen in my life, things that I hear sounds that I cannot, I don't know what they are, or I get a fear of a certain sound, or I have a dream, or there's something that happened. He looks in his diary. So he's really very, very happy. And he keeps on telling us and asking us, how can I help you to spread that story? So that's really from a patient perspective, one of the most successful stories. He's really, really thankful that he had this opportunity, and so has his wife, right? Because it was his wife that was the one with family members and nurses that wrote in it. But he said it really made his recovery a much better recovery than. Then maybe without it, right? You could never really measure it against, the not having it. But this is what we hear a lot from patients, or from patients that sometimes did not have it, and said, I would love to have it.
And that speaks to how user-friendly it is too. Cause then I think of an app, changing now, even our older people are getting much more literate with technology. Yeah. Yeah. But that could be a barrier. I'm thinking of some of our veterans hospitals. Would this work for all demographics of society? Maybe not. But to have someone in their 60s, and that's not, in my mind, that's not that old. But it's so user-friendly. Even when they're in a stressful, traumatic situation, they can use this kind of technology easily.
Well, you see, even, and maybe we should not even talk about old or young, but, you know, there are people that are, you know, more used to technology and people that have more of an aversion against technology. And so, but what we do see is that almost everyone has a mobile phone nowadays, and they are able to text. Most people are able to text. And so this is why we made the application so much like a texting application. So there's not a lot of buttons. It's really just as if you're talking to your loved one or talking to the application, just by a simple conversational, you could say, trick that we included to make it very natural to talk or to write. I think that's there was a research done in Europe with our application. Actually, the results came out a couple of weeks ago that specifically looked at the technological barriers for families and for nurses. And it found that there were hardly any. So the mean age for that group was around 55. So that means there were some older and some younger people in there. And there were no real technical hurdles for most people. The most of the times, the technical hurdles are on the hospital or nursing side. Not so much because they don't know how to do it, but sometimes some nurses see it as yet another administrative task. So this is part of our education, or of our mission also, to talk to nurses and to learn nurses that this is not an administrative task. This is really part of the care. This is why it's in the ABCDF bundle. This is why it's recommended by intensivists and nurses as part of the care, as part of family engagement, and not so much as an administrative task. But this is sometimes a hurdle that we still face, that people see it as, well, you know, so many things that I already have to do in a day, and now I also have to write.
I mean, in the States, at least, there's just so much documentation, and some of it's repetitive. And I think already our clinicians are spending too much time on the computer versus with patients. So I could see that being a struggle, especially as you're starting off, and it might take longer because you don't know what to write. You're getting used to it. Anything that's new seems to take more time initially.
Yeah. So there's one thing that we usually, it's also a trick that we sometimes do with hospitals. A lot of hospitals that, at least that we engage with our application, they provide iPads to write on. Some of them do it on the bedside terminals, but there are a lot that say, well, we have specific iPads for them, because then the nurses can also take a picture with that iPad and include it in the diary. So one of the things, and this is what we've learned from nurses. Nurses said, if you put Netflix on the same iPad, it will always be charged, and then we'll always be confronted with the application as well. And this is because they were telling us, well, in the night shifts, there's enough time to write. Yes, it can be busy at some times, and you can never really predict how it's going, but usually there's more time during the night. So early mornings, an hour before the shift stops, and you would be a great time to write. And also, if you write in the morning, like 6-7 o'clock in the morning, you know, family members will open up the app and will read about their loved one and will not call the ICU. So this will save them some time as well. So this is how we work, and this is what we do together with nurses. This is not what we are telling they have to do, but in the way that we are designing this, we are including the practice of nursing and try to adapt it as much as possible to their way of working. Otherwise, you know, it's like I said, just another thing they need to do. And now it sort of becomes something that they like to do, and that they feel is natural to do, because it's part of their care and not so much part of the administration.
Yeah. Throughout the consulting, I've learned a lot of things about systems and processes, and absolutely every ICU is different. They have their own culture, their own processes. You know, some ICUs are going to have more surgeries, procedures, patients leave. Yeah. You've got to build in this kind of intervention into that individual ICU, and you've got to have nursing buy-in, and nurses need to be part of figuring out what works for the team. So having someone from above or the side barking out orders can provide ideas and share what's worked for other ICUs. But this is something that the team as a whole needs to decide to do and figure out how to do it and streamline the process.
Yes, Absolutely. I think that's crucial. And yeah, like you said, if you're implementing something in an ICU, you really have to make sure it becomes something that belongs to how they operate and not so much a foreign application or procedure that they don't feel is naturally fitting with what their job is. So that's true. But on the other hand, if I then look at the 25-30 ICUs that we have it implemented, generally they're a lot the same. I mean, the same things happen. And yes, cultures differ, but in essence, they work mostly with the same EMRs and the same procedures and the same machines and the same sort of people. So there is sort of a standard that that I think is becoming to grow, and hopefully we can roll that standard out into more hospitals. Not so much just the application, but just the practice of writing. And up until now, I don't know if there are a lot. I don't think there are a lot of other digital diaries. But even if there are, I would recommend every ICU to start looking at it, because it's a great way to document that period, and it really helps patients and it really helps families. I think that's something that's still under researched, but the effect it has on prevention of post intensive care family is really important as well. The benefits of journaling, of writing your emotions into text, channeling that into something that is on paper and they can reflect upon, is something that also can help a lot in prevention of problems, traumatic stress syndromes that occur in families.
I had a wife whose husband was intubated, and he was awake and walking for the first few days. And then he got to the point where he couldn't oxygenate with movement, required pronation and paralysis, deep sedation. So, and even when he was awake prior to that, he was delirious. So she was not able to really connect with him during such a stressful time. And he was in his early 30s and he had three little kids. And so she usually during stressful traumatic situations could lean on him, but he was unavailable, but she yearned to connect with him. So writing in the diary, she said it was like I was able to communicate with him.
Yes.
And I think about it. I mean, I text my husband more than I write letters to him. So maybe it would be a quicker, more organic way to talk to him. If it was my husband in that situation, it would feel like you're actually having a conversation, even if you're not, and you're writing to their future selves. So you're planning, you're doing some intervention to prepare them, to help them, and also just planning on the future, like the optimism that must bring to put things into perspective of here we are now, but I'm talking to you, the future you, because I'm hoping that there is going to be a future you. I'm planning on it.
Absolutely. I think that's a great example where the connection it will happen at a later stage, but you're doing it now. And I think this is something, there's not really a terminology for it. We sort of invented it, or at least we gave it a name, social journaling. But basically, you're journaling for someone else. And that's a unique thing, right? You're not just writing for yourself, but you're writing for or to someone else.
Like proxy and not a journaling. Deadline.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I just throughout my journey of podcasting and consulting, I've been gathering up different tools, things to streamline these kind of processes. And so I'm just talking it loud, right? I'm thinking of things that fit into an iPad. Most of our ICUs got iPads during COVID for Zooming. And most of those iPads are collecting dust on the shelf now.
Yeah.
And we use iPads for translative services. But a lot of times it's just a specific iPad. Maybe there are two iPads and one ICU, and they're just, so in my dream ICU, each room would have an iPad, which is actually already accessible in many ICUs. Mm-hmm. There's your app, there's, which can be on the iPad and or on patients' phones, right? But there's also apps like VitaTalk that have communication, not for nonverbal communication in 40 different languages. There are cognitive apps like Sudoku puzzles and things that keep their cognition going. You can be part of occupational and speech therapy. You mentioned Netflix, entertainment. Like you can if we were to really combine all these tools into one, because it feels like a lot to roll it out, but if we kept these things easily accessible and standardized on each iPad for each room, it could, I think that is where we need to be moving towards for the future, when we already have, it's 2024. We have so much technology, but everyone has different levels of progress when it comes to how up to date they are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, so yeah, I think if you walk into most, not just ICUs, but any hospital rooms now, you see phones, chargers, you see tablets, you see all kinds of devices from the patient, from the family, right? And so I think if you would provide something like you just described, and I know there are a few hospitals that are doing something like this, that then you could, well, you don't want to control, but at least you have an influence on things that are on that iPad that you know will be beneficial to the current or the future patient, right? It can be journaling, it can be the cognition games, it can be, you know, these kind of things where you have them there and they're available, and you know that they are a part of the healing or part of the care. I think that would be the future hospital, or I would even say the hospital of today, would need something like that. And it would be great if there were more of those initiatives. I know there are a few. I'm actually visiting one Tuesday in Belgium, where they build a complete new hospital in Antwerp that is aiming to be the future hospital. So I'm going to find out. And I think there are more of those hospitals, but it's still like fragmented, and there's not a lot of visionaries behind that are pushing this, I think. And that would be great. But on the other hand, there are so many digital struggles that hospitals are still going through today. They might be a bit scared to go on this route.
But there's so much potential there. It's like all these companies to get together, have a powwow, have a complete bundle. I've just been trying to make contact with everyone and really make this information accessible to the ICU community throughout the world as a whole. How can they get a hold of you?
Well, of course they can. I mean, they could Google Post ICU Diary, right? Or they could just go to postICU.com. We try to be out there. We try to share as much as possible information and research, but it can always be more so. But if they're looking specifically for us, they could always look at post-icu.com and they would find us. But I would also advise people just to do Google on post-ICU diaries. There's lots of information. There's more and more information coming out. Post-ICU.org also is a great a website that has information from researchers, survivors, and family members. So I think those are a couple of interesting websites to go to. But there's also an ICUdiary.org, I think, from a researcher in Germany. Peter Nino, he's also doing a lot of studies also on diaries, but also on post-intensive care syndrome. So that information is now slowly growing. I would recommend, I know you had him in the podcast also, but I would also recommend to read Wes Ellie's book, Every Deep Dawn Breath, where he describes the diary, and he describes also the benefits of making the connection to the patient and the family, which is part of the diary, right? It's the family engagement part. That also was so inspiring to read, even though we were already busy with the diary. So that's also why we connected with him, and we are setting up a feasibility study with Vanderbilt and Marquette University this year to try to find out what are the barriers to entry in U.S. hospitals, of course, to set the standard, hopefully, or at least a standard for hospitals to start adopting it in the U.S. We only have one hospital now. It's in Derby. It's called Griffin Health in Connecticut, Derby. But we're aiming together with Vanderbilt and Marquette to further the standardization, actually, by doing a feasibility study.
Are you still looking for U.S. hospitals to be participants in the study?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that would be great. We were looking for populations where we could do the research, especially around the Milwaukee area, because Marquette doesn't have their own hospital. So that would be really interesting if there would be hospitals interested, then they could to contact us, of course.
Hey, listeners, raise your hands. Jump in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like basically a free trial, right?
It's a free trial, yeah.
Yeah. What a great opportunity to be a part of something great. I know we have lots of students and researchers part of this podcast. So contact Seth at postic.com. I'll put all the citations to the studies that you referred to, as well as the links that you've mentioned, even Dr. Ely's book, on my website, where the transcript of this episode will be, also in the show notes. Any last thoughts for the IC community?
Start writing.
Right. We start with a notebook, but look to the future. We can streamline this process much better.
Absolutely. Start writing and the rest will follow.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.